prior to my job here, one of the areas that I did research in was looking at the subprime market and thinking about kind of applying a behavioral economics lens to what was happening in subprime. This is before the bust. And looking at behavioral economics and thinking about that, one of the things that we really concluded at the Joint Center was that that education, that neutral education wasn't enough, and that people really turned to a trusted advisor. And a lot of times in the mortgage market, that would be turning to a broker where they might or might not get good advice. So we know that the role of trusted advisors and the role of someone helping a consumer make a good decision is really critical. So my question for the panel is to explore this question about how do we help consumers make good decisions. Is it in other countries you see this real uptake of agents that are selling the products? You know, is it the agent's role to help to educate the consumer? If it's not the agent's role, whose role is it to educate consumers, and how might that be brought in line with the development of these new technologies?
I'll take the agent question for 200. The agent model is the way, is the only way to get to this 2 billion people opportunity. Again, when we think of retail banking, we can have a room bigger than this one full of bankers, and not one of them will tell you that their bank tellers sell product. They tell you that they do consultative advice and they are, you know, they open accounts, they do transactions, but nobody's thinking of selling. Now, on the other hand, you talk to retailers or you talk to mobile operators, and they're all about selling. It's about turning the abstract into something that is tangible. So, you know, when I go into a store and buy a box of Tide, I get what I'm, you know, the packaging, how it's being presented, the price, everything is encapsulated. And I think that's one of the benefits of, without having to deal with building new branches and certifying them and whatnot, being able to leverage retailers is the only way to go. World Bank, CGAP has documented extensively different models, whether it's in South America, Africa, you name it. We think that the role, however, is not just the retailer and the agent, but ultimately financial institutions and regulators. And what it's going to force is, as we started thinking, oh, how do you regulate ATMs, point-of-sale networks, so on and so forth, we now need to start thinking, what's a good way, without forgetting that transactions at retail have to go fast, have to be simple. You can't put the same rules that you applied to a branch back in 1950, apply it to a Walmart store. It has to be a multiple entities converging, FI, retailer, and any other type of entity that is affiliated with that program.
Great. Does anyone else want to?
So, yeah, the perspective that we take is we think that people educate people, right? And so, you know, if you look at the amount of information and data that's out there, it's non-consumable right now. And to be able to actually digest it and turn it into knowledge is way too much for a limited group of enterprises or, you know, companies to do. So, you know, we are of the opinion that if you get enough people out there who can filter the information and deliver insight out of all that information and share it with other people like them, that's the only way you're going to really get to a point of total information conversion into knowledge.
I would just say that I think you have to think about who has an interest in teaching and what they have an interest in teaching, right? So to choose a couple of examples, employers have a vested interest in teaching their workforce, at least domestically, to use direct deposit and get away from being unbanked. There's a clear, quantifiable financial benefit for that. Think about the armed services. I don't have figures to back this up, but I'm pretty sure I'm right that they have a tremendous readiness problem with troops that are in financial crisis, right? So they have a very vested interest in trying to address that, whatever financial crisis means. If we think about USAA, I don't know if this is entirely accurate, but to the extent that having members photographing their own checks is more efficient than having those members mail checks into a service center where they have to be processed, then USAA has an interest in educating its members about how to do that, why to do that, when to do that, so forth. So I don't know that that gets us to fully inform consumers, but I think it's useful to remember there are different stakeholders that share an interest in this. And to bring us back to mobile, I'm not sure that employers have known whether there is an effective way to persuade their employees of the benefits of being banked or banked in some sense and using direct deposit when the choice was work with a nonprofit partner who wants to talk about gathering people into groups and having a two-hour workshop. You know, that doesn't look very scalable. What if there's now a mobile application that they can put on the intranet, their own intranet, or make widely available to their workforce, and over time that workforce is accustomed to getting apps on their smartphones, you know, that feels like something that you could see an HR person say, yeah, what's the cost to do that? You know, I can do that. So there may be an opportunity that's new going forward.
I would just add that I think we really need to be talking about this topic in terms of deep integration. But if we continue to talk about financial education or financial literacy or financial information as separate from the stuff that people do every day, that there's going to continue to be a disconnect, that the more we can embed information into the way in which products are designed and delivered, the way in which we communicate with customers, the way in which people communicate with each other, I think we're going to be more effective all around because of the way adults tend to learn. That Tim talked about essentially what are teachable moments or what are important moments in time. You know, what are also relevant moments, right? So don't talk to someone about home ownership when they've got $40,000 of, you know, bills to pay. You know, being relevant, being timely, being actionable, enabling someone to take action immediately, as opposed to talking about some hypothetical, and then finding ways for it to be ongoing. And I think those elements, in many ways, mobile is a real opportunity because it offers immediacy, timeliness, actionability, all the things that we think make for effective interactions with consumers.
Great. Well, now I'd love to give you all a chance to speak up. It looks like Jim Van Dyke might have a question in the back.
Hey, thanks. So we're going to be, we're talking with several organizations about supporting a very quantitative study about cash usage, the big blind spot, particularly with resilient with underserved audience, first in the U.S., and it will include checks and electronic payments, try to, first with merchants and then with consumers. So my question is to the people on the panel, is there, can you think of anything that you think, that you imagine would be most helpful to know about either merchants' policies regarding cash, check, and as it relates to electronic payments, mobile, whatever, but especially the blind spot of cash, as well as consumer behavior and attitude? What would you like to know that you think we don't know today?
Great. Someone want to jump in on that?
I would add, I mean, intuitively, we've every time that we see spending that doesn't make sense, the logical part, I will actually counter that everything is logical. And so any questions that are able to shed some light, I'll give you a quick example. So, for example, you say, somebody who doesn't have savings, and so you don't even have $2,000 in case you get sick or you don't have any kind of long-term retirement plan. The reason why that happens is because you end up having a perception that, hey, I'm just living day to day. So if you're fighting a war in Afghanistan, you don't know if you're going to come home or not. Maybe all of a sudden you say, hey, I don't care about what's going on stateside. I just need to worry about today, tomorrow. Well, for a lot of people in certain parts of Detroit, Atlanta, New York City, that's what's happening. So we really need to start getting into what are some of the real-time transaction costs that are keeping people from really looking at a more of a medium-term time horizon. Those are the type of questions that we would like to see. So when I don't pay my electric bill today, do I not pay it because I know I got 30 days, 60 days before it gets disconnected? And so, you know, is that, even though I know that my credit report may get shut, but who cares about my credit report because I just care about having electricity today?
Great. Another question here, Bridget?
Hi. Thank you. I'm Catherine Ryman from Citi, and I just wanted to pick up on a comment that Jennifer made earlier that I think is something of a segue between this conversation and what should policymakers be looking for. Jennifer, you said that large banks were basically taking a defensive approach to mobile banking, and I'm not sure if you realize how interesting and apt that terminology is. Because one of the concerns in the large bank space is that we have obligations really in excess of what you read in the law to know customers and also to look at transactions. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an uncertainty right now in terms of how in the examination space, which is where the standards that we live by get made, mobile banking, particularly acquisition and oversight of transactions, is going to be dealt with. And I think that you will see change when you see more certainty in that space.
Jennifer, do you want to start?
I'm really glad you brought that up because I think it'll be an important topic for the next couple of panels that are coming. But we are in an interesting time in that in this country, we seem to be saying we value regulated institutions, but we're making it harder than ever for regulated institutions to reach deeper, serve more broadly. There's an inherent tension there, and it's there's important arguments on either side of the tension. When we all understand why that tension exists, but we're having sort of a parallel conversation, if you will, when we think about the mortgage markets, for instance, and getting or Wall Street. And getting rid of the shadow banking system, right? This unregulated people, and making them more regulated and transparent. But the same could be said of a whole range of non-bank financial services provided in the consumer finance sector. But we haven't really taken that framework for the conversation and brought it over here. And I think what many of us are saying is that there are important things to borrow from the non-bank sector, but how can we do it in a way that's going to be responsible, transparent, bring all the needed consumer protections? And so I think you make a really important point.
And when it comes to regulation, you know, you had asked that question to me 3 years ago. I was like, what's wrong with this country? We have 50 different state regulators. We got, you know, within the federal ones, we have 4 or 5, then we have all these law enforcement agencies. How can we get anything done? And 3 years later, after going international, I'll tell you, we live in an amazing country. I mean, we should all be extremely proud of the country we live in and the rule of law and how simple and efficient it is, despite everything that we don't realize, but it takes some comparison. So, for example, we can get our entire constitution in 1-2 pages, one page if you use the right font. And yet most countries ends up being a volume with 500 pages. And the impact on that is that in places, for example, Mexico, that if that which you want to do, that new program that you want to innovate, bundle, whatever it is, if it has to do with money, if it's not explicitly authorized in the regulation, you can't do it. Oh, by the way, the valuation for that is you go to jail. And so therefore, you're not able to get the types of innovation and traction. And so I know that after 2008, 2009, when we start thinking about, hey, let things be, let's do what we did in the times of the dot-com e-commerce world of sort of let it be and let's catch up with it. That 1997 Federal Reserve paper on store value, sort of like, we don't know, let's let it be until we get to understand it. It encapsulates what our system, legal system has, the approach that it has had. But after 2008, 2009, we get very nervous. But the reality is that, I don't know about you guys, but I will gladly take the pain of this recession that we have and keep the 5% growth year over year for 200 years. And that's why we're the nation we are. So.
Great. We have time for one more question if there's someone else from the audience. Does anyone else want to reflect on looking at internationally, thinking about how mobile has developed, the kind of tension between, you know, financial institutions and non-bank or other types of providers that are really leading internationally, and anything else you want to reflect on with regards to how we might see that roll out in the U.S.?
Well, I would just say that, you know, before the last 2 years, it was easier to see how in this country maybe the telco could become the bank. So I love the fact that the first question was from someone at the FDIC earlier this morning asking about, well, what if the telco were the bank? What regs could we port over to make sure that their the consumer protection is covered, et cetera? And I, in this environment, it's just so much harder to see that happening from a regulatory perspective. Forget about the marketplace and who's willing to partner with whom. But I think that as we grapple with these issues, it's really important to think about where are the consumers that we want to serve? What's the best and most effective way to reach them? How do they already do their business? What need are we really filling? And start from there and then work backwards to say, well, if it is a retailer or if it is a telco or if it is someone else, what can we do to make sure that they can be part of the mix, but also that we're paying attention so that consumers get the protection that they deserve?
I think from borrowing from the international, we don't have huge monopolies both in the banking side or in the telecom side. So partnerships is simply the way that it has worked and that we believe at least that it's going to go. If you asked, and you know this is complete conjecture, but I gotta believe that if you were to ask Jane Thompson at Walmart, you know, what did you lose by not getting the charter? She probably will tell you that the bulk of what they wanted to do and wanted to accomplish, they were able to do without the charter. And if you said, hey, how many of the headaches do you think you saved by not being a bank? She'd probably tell you that a vast majority of the headaches she didn't have to get into. So retailers, telecom operators, and others, they don't want to be banks. And it really allows us to think of what are the strengths? So if I'm a mobile operator, what are my strengths? If I'm a retailer, what are my strengths? If I'm the bank, I think what you're going to see is not that the new models in the United States are going to displace banks. I think banks are going to morph into a different type of role